Welcome to ArchaeoEd, a podcast about the civilizations of the ancient Americas. You know, the ones that American history books never talk about. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Barnhart. I've been an archaeologist, an explorer, and a seeker of esoteric knowledge all over the planet for over 30 years now. In this podcast, I'll share what I've learned. Sometimes it'll be stories of my adventures. Other times, it'll be things I've learned along the way. It'll be whatever I feel like talking about because this is my podcast, Beholden to No One. Are you ready? I'm ready. Let's go. Season 5, Episode 9, Tiwanaku. For this last episode of Season 5, I've decided to focus on the ancient city and larger civilization of Tiwanaku. The ancient city of Tiwanaku is so amazing that certain people feel the need to explain it through extreme theories. Aliens, Atlantis, giants, the usual suspects. But no, once again, it was just humans. Amazingly capable humans, but from right here on regular old Earth. Despite its size and grandeur, Tiwanaku remains a fairly obscure archaeological site. So let me start with our 5 W's to make sure everyone starts on the same page. First, where is Tiwanaku? That's part of why so few people know about it. It's not easy to get to. It's in the high Andes Mountains of northern Bolivia, just south of Lake Titicaca. The valleys around Lake Titicaca are referred to as the Altiplanos, or the High Plains in English. They are in fact so high that trees don't naturally grow there. Tiwanaku is at 12,500 feet above sea level. Today, the easiest way to get there is flying into La Paz and traveling by road about 70 kilometers to the northwest, a journey I've made 3 times in my life. Bolivia's foreign visa policies towards Americans are onerous. Its infrastructure is minimal, and it's in an almost constant state of social unrest. Despite all that, I would go back to Tiwanaku in a heartbeat. The city's location is cold, windy, and barren. Not the kind of place you'd expect to find an ancient city. As I'll explain later, it was raised field agriculture that allowed them not just to survive, but thrive. One more where fact. To my knowledge, Tiwanaku is the highest elevation ancient city on the planet. There are higher archaeological sites, but not ancient cities. If anyone knows of a higher one, feel free to school me in the comments. Okay, next. What is Tiwanaku? Tiwanaku is an ancient urban center with a peak population of around 20,000 people. Some people say more, but 20,000 is plenty. Its name means roughly stone at the center in Aymara, though it's unlikely that that was the city's original name. The Huaqueira River runs through it, and that was the city's lifeblood. It watered their raised fields and supplied the water for a moat surrounding the city center. That city center is where almost all of the major architecture was located. Only the Pumapunku complex is outside of that moat's loop. The river is on the east and north sides, and that's where the raised fields are. Mostly corn was planted. The community lived there, along the river, and on the outer parts of the city in every direction. The stubs of all those houses are just under the ground surface, often indicated by little more than scatters of potsherds now. Overall, the city covered about 4 square kilometers. When did the city of Tiwanaku exist as a living place? The modern, archaeologically grounded answer is 100 BCE to 1000 CE. So overall, for about 1,000 years and ending about 1,000 years ago. The city's most dynamic times were between 300 and 700 CE. That's when most of their building, or at least the increase in building, occurred. There are hints of settlements going back to 500 BCE, but then it was just a small little community, nothing like the city it became. There was also some settlement that stayed on past 1000 CE, but really just squatters. Now, if you frequent the right websites, you can find people suggesting that Tiwanaku is 11,000 years old. Some will even go back to 17,000 years old. But those originate in the long-dispelled theories of a man named Arthur Poznanski, and they are from the 1940s. He was a Bolivian of Polish descent, an engineer by training. He came up with those extreme dates through a fundamental misunderstanding of both geology and archaeoastronomy. In his 1945 book, Tiwanaku, the Cradle of American Man, he theorized that not only were those extreme dates true, but that both the Inca and Maya civilizations began there in Tiwanaku. His theories are long discredited, but his photos of Tiwanaku are still very valuable. So, just to restate it, Tiwanaku's dates are 100 BCE through 1000 CE, not Ice Age. Who built Tiwanaku? Pretty much everyone agrees that it was the Aymara people, the dominant indigenous group in Bolivia to this day. They were there when the Inca showed up in the 1300s, and still there when the Spanish showed up. In fact, the Aymara still consider the site sacred and hold June solstice ceremonies there every year. I was there for one about a decade ago and surprised to see over 10,000 Aymara people in attendance. An Aymara priest sacrificed a black llama in front of the frozen crowd. It was dawn in the dead of winter. That was the moment where worshiping the sun became real personally to me. Also, Bolivia's first Aymara president, Evo Morales, chose to be inducted into office not in La Paz, but in Tiwanaku. Maybe it wasn't completely Aymara 1,000 years ago, but it definitely is now. Finally, the big question, why was Tiwanaku created? That's a hard one to answer completely, but I'll give you my thoughts on it. I think it was a pilgrimage center and a gathering place for religion and trade, a kind of crossroads between the area that extended all the way to the Pacific Ocean and all the way into the Amazon. Its name, meaning stone at the center, kind of hints at that. Aside from its remote location and population size, it's the megalithic stones found at Tiwanaku that really capture the world's imagination. They're everywhere at the site, both as carved monuments and building blocks. Most are made of andesite, but a few of the largest are made of red sandstone. Both are from quarries at least 10 kilometers away. Even the smallest of them are multi-ton, and a few of them are outrageously large. In the section called Pumapunku, a single sandstone slab is 131 tons in weight. Dozens of other stones exceed 20 tons each. Those that are architectural pieces are precision cut and fit together perfectly. It's those precision cuts that get people invoking alien contact. I, of course, do not subscribe to that, and I hope to explain why in this episode. With our five W's out of the way, let's talk about the history of investigations at the site. Sadly, Tiwanaku today is a hot mess. A lot of looting has gone on, big stones have been moved from their original locations, and the state archaeologists have reconstructed parts of the site terribly. Especially in a complex called the Kalasasaya, archaeologists have built entire walls that never existed. Monuments have also been moved, some of them all the way to La Paz, none of them at the site are still in their original location for sure, and some of them are verifiably not in their original locations. The very first European to see and report Tiahuanaco was conquistador Pedro Cieza de León in 1549. That was a decade after the Inca were conquered. By then, the Spanish understood that the Inca Empire was broken up into Tiwantinsuyu, the land of four quarters. Quayasuyu was the southern quarter, and Cieza de León was searching for its capital. Tiahuanaco was large enough to fit the bill, but it was clearly just an Inca-recognized ancient ruin. Even then, the site was being pilfered for its square blocks. For the next 300 years or so, Tiahuanaco was ignored by the outside world. An Aymara community took up residence in the northwest section of the site during that time, but likely didn't do too much damage. Yes, stone blocks were reused, but not much in the way of looting occurred at their hands. To the Aymara, it's a sacred city of their ancestors. They wouldn't do that. American explorer Ephraim Squier visited Tiahuanaco in the 1860s. He made some important drawings and maps, but the camera had not yet become a mobile device. In one drawing, he depicted a row of standing monoliths, naming it American Stonehenge. Those stones are still there, in the Calasasaya, but Bolivian restoration teams built stone walls between them. It wasn't that way when Squier drew it up, but alas, it remains a solid wall to this day. A few Germans led teams to make more maps in the 1870s, and those were the same people that took the very first photos in the 1890s, but then the Aymara locals ran them off. More photos were taken in 1905. The monoliths were still separate, and a stone doorway called the Sun Gate sat broken and partially buried in an uncertain location. It was sometime between then and the 1960s when the strange reconstructions and monument moving happened. I'm still seeking publication sources of who did it and why. By the 1960s, the Bolivian government finally got serious about site protection and preservation. Since then, a combination of Bolivian and international teams have been slowly excavating and restoring Tiahuanaco. Alan Colada of the University of Chicago made large contributions, excavating on and off from 1978 into the 1990s. Today, there's a great site museum and a team actively excavating the largest temple, the Acapana. Okay, first commercial break here. When I return, we'll talk about specific buildings and monuments.
A Little Bit de Todo is a podcast about a little bit of everything for curious minds of all ages. I'm Christina, and you can tune in every weekday to learn about things like Cinco de Mayo, Chihuahuas, and volcanoes in Latin America. Episodes are bite-sized, 10 minutes long or less, and always Latin American related. Subscribe and follow A Little Bit de Todo podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey. This is Ed Barnhart, shamelessly plugging myself again. This time it's about an iPhone app I made called Tulum Be Your Own Guide. It's an app designed to help you be your own guide through Tulum. Its route is a map of Tulum, in which you can click on any building to get a description. You can read that description or press audio to hear me narrate it. It's not a static route through the site. You can go anywhere you want. You can point your phone at any structure and hit the What's That button. You can also click on any building and say Take Me There for a directional arrow and a distance feature function. You can really be your own guide. And though admittedly not my intention, making the app's information as complete as possible, I accidentally wrote the most complete book on Tulum ever made. No other single source has as much information about Tulum. It's only 99 cents, and you can find it on the Apple App Store. Once again, it's called Tulum, Be Your Own Guide, and the author is me, Edwin Barnhart. Whether you plan to visit Tulum or just want to learn more about it, it's an invaluable resource. Let's talk about the major archaeological site of Tiahuanaco. Most people drive there from La Paz and visit as a day trip. It's only about 70 kilometers away, but it still takes over 3 hours to get there. La Paz is in a valley, but it's still the world's highest capital city at 12,000 feet above sea level. 2 million people live there. It takes a while to drive up and out of its valley, and then you're in another city of 1 million people called El Alto. El Alto is kind of scary because most of the people that live there don't have running water or electricity. It's a kind of lawless town. But once clear, the road gets long and flat out to the ruins. Tourists arrive to the on-site museum. Very nice, really. Great artifact collection, including gold, textiles, and lots of pottery. A few of Tiahuanaco's famous monuments are housed there, too. The complex closest to the museum is called the Calasasaya. It's an easy, flat walk, so it's the most visited part of the site. It's a big, open courtyard surrounded by walls, about the size of 2 football fields. The stubs of the walls were still there when archaeologists arrived, but we're not sure how tall they were originally. It was reconstructed terribly, especially on the eastern side. That side was lined with freestanding monoliths about 4 meters apart originally. They're in Poznanski's photos from 1903, just like they were in Squire's 1860s drawing. But sometime after that, a restoration team decided to fill in the gaps with stone walls and fill dirt on its west side to raise it up to the level of the interior courtyard. The center of that eastern wall has a big staircase, standing alone in the old photos. Again, inexplicably, restorers built a stone archway at the top of those stairs. Now it looks nothing like it did in the old photos. It's widely acknowledged as totally made up. The Calasasaya, like all buildings of the city center, was aligned to cardinal directions. Looking east from its center, now through a fabricated gate, one can view the equinox sunrise. And from the western entrance, one can see the solstice rising over the courtyard's corners. I was there once for June's solstice sunrise, so I saw it happen, and I can confirm that's true. Just off center of the courtyard, probably misplaced as well, stands the Ponce monolith. The stone itself is 3.5 meters tall and about 9 tons. Carved in shallow bas-relief on all sides, it depicts a man standing in ceremonial regalia and holding 2 objects in front of his chest. The carving is very low relief, and the stone's shape from a distance looks more like a column than a statue. Aside from art carved into doorways or sticking out of walls, this low-relief stela or monolith form is how all the statues at Tiahuanaco look. I'm honestly not sure how many of them there are at Tiahuanaco. The actual field reports are really hard to come by. But one is named Stela 15, so we can be sure that there are at least 15 from the site. Most of them have variations of the same theme as on the Ponce monolith, a single standing figure in elaborate costume holding objects in both hands. They vary greatly in size. Some are smaller than a person. The largest is the Bennett monolith, standing a crazy 7.3 meters tall and weighing 27 tons. It's got the same basic message. A man standing with 2 objects in his hands. In the Bennett's case, those objects are a Karo cup, made for drinking corn beer, and a snuff plate, meant for sniffing hallucinogenic powders. If I didn't know these were for ceremonial use, I'd say that that guy was ready to party. But they are almost certainly related to ceremonies that occurred in their presence, so their iconography has important meanings. When I look at them and their iconographic elements, I see the Fang deity. I see his goggle eyes, his fangs, the snakes coming out of his head and waist, and the claws on his hands and feet. I see the same on the central figure of Tiahuanaco's famous sun gate. That figure is oftentimes identified as the sun god, but other people call him the staff deity. He's called the staff deity because he holds two staffs out from his body on the left and right. But further, that name, staff deity, comes from a much older statue found far away at the site of Chavín de Huántar in the mountains of northern Peru. That image appears on the Raimundi stone. Not only is its figure holding the staffs, but it has the fangs, claws, and snakes, just like Tiahuanaco's sun gate figure. We know it's the Fang deity over at Chavín de Huántar. Why isn't he the Fang deity at Tiahuanaco? My colleague's resistance about that is distance and time. The two sites are separated by over 1,000 years and almost 2,000 kilometers. And yes, those are good reasons. But to me, it's instead proof of the strength and longevity of the religion centered around the Fang deity. If it was just this connection to the sun gate, I'd be less inclined to once again climb on my Fang deity soapbox. But the similarities to Chavín de Huántar don't end there. Going back to the Ponce and Bennett monoliths, their figures look just like one carved on the walls of Chavín de Huántar's new temple. I'll put a comparison of those statues in my show notes so you can see the similarities for yourself. But it's that same figure holding two things in front of its chest with all of those fangs and eyes and snake elements. There's also a similarity in the construction of sunken courts out in front of temples. Chavín de Huántar has a rectangular sunken court in front of its main temple. The Cala Sasaya has the same out its front on the east side. There it's called the Subterranean Temple. But don't let its name fool you. It's the same architectural feature. The gigantic Bennett monolith once stood at its center, but now it's at the site museum. Where it should be standing are three other smaller monoliths dug up in other parts of the site. Why are they there now? Maybe because tourists will see them there? It's another example of Tiahuanaco's terrible reconstruction. But that sunken court has another callback to Chavín, the tenon heads on its walls. Covering all four walls are human heads poking out, anchored into the walls with long backstones called tenons. The back wall of Chavín de Huántar's temple has the same tenon heads, but there they're transforming into jaguars, or more likely channeling the Fang deity as their hallucinogens start to take hold. I'm trying to talk about Tiahuanaco here, so I'll stop before I get too deep in the weeds on the Fang deity. But let what I've said here suffice to convey, I think Tiahuanaco was worshipping the Fang deity. Okay, I'll move on to the single largest construction at Tiahuanaco, the Acapana Pyramid. It was once a beautiful pyramid surrounded in attached building complexes, but sadly, it's now in a very destroyed state. The ravages of time, looting, and I'm sorry to say some bad archaeology are to blame for its current state. I was encouraged by reports of a new restoration project at Acapana, but then discouraged by a follow-up news that the project had been shut down. Apparently, the restoration team was building adobe walls where none had ever existed. So, it was kind of the same program that they used to reconstruct the Cala Sasaya. The structure itself is very large, 200 by 250 meters at its base and 17 meters tall. That's about the height of a six-story building for those of you who continue to reject the metric system. The top platform is where the worst damage occurred. A real shame. Originally, the building had another sunken court on top, in the shape of an Andean cross. It was big, maybe 100 meters across, and it stepped down into a central courtyard. I bet a statue stood there once. But looters dug into it, likely looking for tombs. They blew out its eastern side, destroying whatever water management features it may have had. That probably happened hundreds of years ago. No one's exactly sure when the looting occurred. But since that time, rainy seasons have hammered the hole, widening it and eroding the pyramid's entire east side. Tourists can still climb to the top and walk around. Standing monoliths, flat stones like stela, surround what was left of the sunken court. They're spaced about as wide as the megaliths along the Kalasasia's east side. Thank goodness nobody built a wall between them. A few of those megaliths are magnetic. I tested them with my compass. I'm not sure why or how they're magnetic, but I had read about it and I confirmed it for myself. Yes, they are. The pyramid's staircase is on the west side. At its base and wrapping around to the north and south are a series of interconnected rooms. The ones on the north side were open during my last visit, and I hear that excavations are now opening more. I also heard that they're finding more tenon heads in the walls there, just like in the sunken court. Some have suggested that the rooms were elite residential areas, and certainly the artifacts found there were upper class. But I think it was more of a religious complex, perhaps living quarters for a priestly class. A section of the site called Putuni, just to the west of the Kalasasaya, is a better candidate for a royal palace. It's big, with a private central courtyard, and a ton of elite artifact classes were found within it. Gold, silver, textiles, high-quality ceramics, and trash middens indicating that lots of ocean fish were found there. Definitely sounds posh to me. The other big section of Tiwanaku that I should discuss is Pumapunku. My trouble is that it's a big topic. So I think I'll leave it for my One More Thing segment. I want more people to listen to that anyway, so if you want to know about it, tune in there. So instead, I'll take my last commercial break here. When I return, we'll talk about Tiwanaku's connections to the world outside the city's ancient borders.
Moving is right up there with death and divorce in the Stress Olympics. But fear not. Turn that box of woes into a crate of woes with moving tips in the Life Beyond Boxes podcast with Premium Q Moving. Dive into the world of hassle-free moves, learn tips and tricks to save on cash and your sanity. Say goodbye to those moving meltdowns and hello to the smooth sailings. Or should we say smooth movings? Tune into Life Beyond Boxes with Premium Q Moving on lifebeyondboxes.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. And with us, unpack the secrets to a stress-free move.
After years of hard work, software engineer Matt Neal and I have created the most sophisticated Maya calendar date conversion calculator ever made. We call it Bars and Dots, and we're giving it away for free. Bars and Dots is the name handed down to us from the man who made the world's first Maya calendar software, Sid Hollander. Sid left us in May of 2022. But his memory lives on through Bars and Dots. This resource is not for the casual learner. If you're new to the Maya calendar, it's guaranteed to make your eyes cross. But for those who really want to know the depths of its sophistication and intricacies, Bars and Dots is for you. Check it out and play with it at barsanddots.com. That's barsanddots.com. If you're a math nerd like me, it'll blow your mind. I I want to start talking about Tiwanaku's connection to the outside world. And that begins with its origins. Since the days of Poznanowski, people have been suggesting that Tiwanaku just popped up out of nowhere, complete with incredible engineering skills. But with most claims like that, there's a cultural evolution that needs to be ignored to believe it. In this case, it's the Yaya, Mama, and Chiripa cultures that existed for a millennium before Tiwanaku. Yaya Mama culture was on the north end of Lake Titicaca, and Chiripa was on the south, not far from where Tiwanaku would emerge. Both were in full swing by 1200 BCE, building stone architecture, sunken courtyards, and column-like carved monoliths. We see all of those things in later Tiwanaku, and there's no logical reason not to see them as a continuum. And also, they were chronologically contemporaries with Chavín de Huántar. At least to me, that connects a lot of the dots. By 500 BCE, Pucará was the big Yaya Mama site in the north, and Tiwanaku was growing beyond the size of Chiripa. By the way, to me, Yaya Mama and Chiripa look very much alike. I think they could be considered the same culture. But as I've admitted before, I'm a lumper, not a splitter. My splitter colleagues would object to all my dot connecting. In any event, it's clear that Tiwanaku grew out of an older cultural tradition around Lake Titicaca. It didn't just appear out of thin air. Okay, now with that under our belts, how about during Tiwanaku's height? How far did their influence reach? The answer is impressively far. Not Inca far, but at least Chavín far, and in much the same ways. Tiwanaku's influence reached down into the Amazon, to the Pacific coast via the Atacama Desert, around Lake Titicaca, and into the Andes. Their connection to the Amazon was particularly strong. The Amazonian province of Bolivia named Cochabamba is full of Tiwanaku-influenced sites. Mostly ceramics make the case, to be honest, but it's still a very strong case. But that Amazon connection is best seen at Tiwanaku itself, first and foremost in their agricultural system. It's raised fields, rows of berms piled up with canals of water running in between them. That's the way they work. The origins of that farming technique are in the Amazon, not in the Andes. They're older than Tiwanaku, and even older than Yaya Mama, who also had raised field technology. The Wari would invent agricultural terracing, ideal for the Andes, but raised fields are from Amazonian traditions. Another big Amazonian thing at Tiwanaku is the artifact type we call snuff plates. Made of wood or ceramic, they're flat, rectangular plates. Their borders are often carved with beautiful designs. They're called snuff plates or trays or tablets because they were used in the Amazon to snuff ayahuasca powder. That's a powerful hallucinogen used by Amazonian shamans. They're found with frequency at Tiwanaku, and Tiwanaku-influenced sites have them as well. Despite their Amazonian origin, they're really considered diagnostically Tiwanaku. That's how many of them they made, even though they're really Amazonian in inspiration. Those snuff plates are often decorated with my third Amazonian item, jaguar iconography. Some try to argue they're pumas, not jaguars, but they're wrong. They are jaguars, and so is the Fang deity. The frequency of jaguar iconography at Tiwanaku in and of itself makes the case for Amazonian contact. Heading the opposite direction, Tiwanaku also had an outpost in the Atacama Desert. The site and nearby modern city are called San Pedro de Atacama. It's a cool place, an oasis with a geyser, salt flats, and pink flamingos. There had been a corn farming settlement there since at least 300 BCE. But in 500 CE, it's clear that Tiwanaku took over management. Their ceramics, textiles, and those snuff plates appear in San Pedro de Atacama about that time and last until about 1000 CE. Conversely, copper and salt were traded back to the city of Tiwanaku. The closest Tiwanaku settlement to the city itself was in the Moquegua Valley, about 350 kilometers to the west in modern Peru. That Moquegua Valley is a very interesting case for archaeology, in that two cultures lived there at the same time, the Tiwanacans and the Wari. The Wari were a civilization centered in the Ayacucho Valley, well to the north. They were an expansionistic culture, establishing a number of colonies to their north, and a lot of them by military force. I actually have a whole podcast episode about the Wari. Look back to season 4 if you want to learn more about them. Here, we're just concerned with the Wari who lived in the Moquegua Valley. They lived there in apparent harmony with the Tiwanacan inhabitants. And given Wari's compunction for conquest, that's a little odd. But the Wari lived there in the upper parts of the valley, and the Tiwanacans farmed the areas at the base along the river. The Tiwanacans were using their raised field techniques, while the Wari were building agricultural terraces. Both worked fine, until drought conditions set in at about 1000 CE. The Tiwanacan cornfields started failing, and their communities were abandoned. The Wari terraces kept going. In fact, their communities increased in size and remained there for another 200 years. Back at Tiwanaku, recent DNA studies have proven that they were a multicultural place. Genetic profiles from the Atacama, but especially the Amazon, were detected. About 1000 CE, the same drought conditions that hit the Moquegua Valley hit the city too. That was certainly part of Tiwanaku's demise, but there's also evidence of burning, specifically at the Putuni complex. That's the one we think was a royal palace. Perhaps drought made food resources tight and the population got sick of how the elite were handling it. But in any event, Tiwanaku was abandoned about then, in 1000 CE. Okay. Well, that's a wrap for this episode and season 5. As I always do, I'll take the summer off to travel. And this summer, I'll be working on a new Olmec lecture series too. To my Patreon supporters, thank you for sticking with me during the summer. As a special thank you to you, I'll be continuing my little segment One More Thing through the summer. My plan is to go back to the season 5 episodes that don't have One More Thing segments and do those. To all my listeners, I appreciate you. Through your listenership and support, you make my life more fun. Season 6 of ArchaeoEd will begin September 1st. Until then, this is Ed, signing off. You've been listening to ArchaeoEd, a podcast written, recorded, and voiced by me, Ed Barnhart. If you like what you heard, please like, share, comment, and do all that other stuff I'm supposed to ask you to do. And if you really liked it, consider supporting ArchaeoEd through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com and search for ArchaeoEd. I'm in there somewhere. I make these podcasts for free, but I'm not opposed to making money. In fact, if you folks could free me from my day job, well, I'd be much obliged. ArchaeoEd is my intellectual property, all rights reserved, copyright 2024.